Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Glorious Lessons, John Trumbull, Painter of the American Revolution, by Richard Brookhiser, narrated by Rick Adamson. A Note on Spelling. Rules of spelling and punctuation have changed between John Trumbull's time and ours, and letter writers then, as now, often made their own rules. I have regularized and modernized liberally for ease of listening. I have followed Trumbull's usage in writing Bunker's Hill and his age's usage in writing Indian and Indians. Introduction. When Colonel John Trumbull, artist and Revolutionary War veteran, was an old man, he said, "Let those who think it is an easy thing to paint a picture go to that wall and make it tell a story." From youth, he was born in 1756, to old age, he died in 1843, he painted stories and subjects drawn from many sources: history, sacred and secular literature, people he knew, people who paid him, people he observed on the sly. He produced or designed many other works besides, both graphic and three-dimensional: battle maps, a college campus, a church. But for half a century, he worked on a series of paintings that told one story, the most important story of his life, the most important, he believed, of all political history. I first saw the wall that tells this story when I was a student. Trumbull left his most important paintings to Yale College. The gallery he designed to hold them was torn down long ago, but the collection remains, as per the terms of his bequest, in a room devoted to it, where I happened upon it one day. I am a writer. Books, columns, reporting are my life. I have never held a painter's brush in my hand, but this wall got my attention, as its creator intended. The paintings on it were then arranged approximately as Trumbull had first grouped them. They have been rearranged since. The colors and the furnishings of the room mimicked a gallery of the early 19th century. Green banquettes, red walls. In the center of the most important wall hung a life-size portrait of a Revolutionary War officer in full uniform. Ranged around it were eight paintings, four on a side, 3 feet long by 2 feet tall, depicting multiple characters, military and civilian, also of the late 18th century. At the extremities of the wall were two arrays of small portraits, each about 4 inches tall. Some of the faces rendered in these reappeared in the larger works, most did not. They were like a casting call. The man in the standing portrait was George Washington. He also dominated 4 of the medium-sized paintings, whether on horseback or standing. 2 of the Washington-less images I recognized from textbooks, or middle-brow coffee table books, or who knows where, so familiar were they. The rest were new to me. There was a lot of color, a lot of information, many moods. There was darkness and death, smoke and panic, a rearing horse, blasted trees. There was also the formality of surrender, when warfare assumes the mask of civility. Away from the battlefield were scenes of political deliberation. White women were there, as well as a number of Native American men and one black man. I grasped some themes. Washington, I concluded, was a star of the show, which is true, though he is not the only one. Other themes I missed entirely. The labels affixed to the frames were confusing as often as they were helpful. I noticed that the dates of completion were years apart, and often out of sync with the order of the events being depicted. The artist had evidently painted out of sequence, and in bursts of activity long removed from each other. But the wall as a whole succeeded in its primary purpose. It got the viewer's attention. This is important. Pay attention. These men and women are dead, but they live here. You do not know them. You do not know them yet. But they had you in mind. Although words can be compelling, the eyes have it. This wall has our eyes. It anticipated visual forms Trumbull never knew. It was a graphic novel, its images less numerous than those in a book, but each one larger and more packed. Glimpsed quickly, it was a movie trailer. Studied slowly, it was the film itself. The story Trumbull aimed to tell was the story of the American Revolution. But it was more than a recap of engagements and parleys, or of sessions of Congress, the Revolutionary Tribunal. In a letter to Thomas Jefferson, one of his subjects, he defined his purpose: to give the present and future sons of oppression and misfortune such glorious lessons of their rights and of the spirit with which they should assert and support them. Trumbull wanted to tell the creation story of America, what it should mean to Americans and what it could mean to the world and to the future. Trumbull put his story on more than a single wall in a collegiate art gallery. He commissioned engravings that would replicate his images as prints, spreading his lessons nation and worldwide, and making, he hoped, a profit for himself. He toured his paintings before hanging them in their destined home, one of the venues in which he showed his depiction of the Declaration of Independence being presented to Congress was Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where the Declaration had been presented to Congress. He labored and schemed to hang vast copies of four of his paintings in the rotunda of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and worked with the architects to make sure that the rotunda would be a space both grand and simple, best calculated to display them. He asked, in vain, to hang copies of four more of his paintings there. At the end of his artistic life, his talent all but gone, he busied himself with somewhat less vast copies that now hang in Hartford, Connecticut. He wrote an autobiography, whose first edition included plates of his works. Other books over the years, commemorative or instructive, have done the same. Now and again, a Trumbull will appear on letters or in wallets, on stamps or bills. They are in America's mind's eye. Trumbull's authority for telling this story was personal. He was born into a political family. His father, Jonathan Trumbull Sr., was the last colonial and first revolutionary governor of Connecticut, the rebel governor, the British called him. His three older brothers all served the cause. John himself was briefly on the staffs of two generals, George Washington and Horatio Gates. He served on the fringes of several battles, in the thick of one. He was shot at. He saw men wounded, killed. Out of uniform, he was jailed by the enemy as a spy. He stayed interested in American politics all his life and met everybody, French and British generals, Creek and Seneca chiefs, six presidents. He worshipped Washington. He was successively Jefferson's protege and wingman, his enemy, and finally his respected long-ago colleague. More important, Trumbull's authority as a storyteller was a product of thought and desire, conviction and will. He made the story of the American Revolution visible because he wanted to. For a little country with no tradition, an ignorant public, and powerful anti-aesthetic impulses, late 18th century America produced a surprising number of capable painters: Benjamin West, John Singleton Copley, Charles Wilson Peale, Gilbert Stuart. The world of art was so small that Trumbull knew them all. His peers left Revolutionary-era portraits and battle scenes, many interesting, some brilliant. Two of them contemplated telling the story of the Revolution in a connected way themselves, but Trumbull alone did it. It took him many years, half of a long life. Many of those years were wasted, as far as his great project was concerned, spent painting other things, spent painting nothing at all. He tried his hand at dealing art, buying and selling old masters. He served as a diplomat in Britain and France. His personal life presented various obstacles. Governor Trumbull never understood why his youngest son wanted to paint. When John explained that he wished to glorify his country as ancient artists had glorified Athens, the governor responded with a line that would have supplied Henry James with a novel or Cole Porter with a lyric. Connecticut is not Athens. The artist married a woman he adored, whom he painted as both the Madonna and the woman taken in adultery. His family did not adore her. She took to drink. He had sired by another woman an illegitimate son, who chose a career he disapproved of, serving in the British Army. When Trumbull tried to talk his son out of it, the young man replied, reasonably enough, "You followed your own inclination in the choice of your profession?" Milton wrote of that one talent which is death to hide. Trumbull could be very good at hiding his, but despite his distractions, temptations, vexations, and sloth, Trumbull's story kept drawing him back. Because he had lived through it, his story has the immediacy of news. It also achieves the comprehensiveness of history. The enemy is not demonized. Trumbull painted British officers into his canvases from life. One of his most sympathetic figures is a mortally wounded Hessian. He depicted a Native American ally and did studies of several more. He produced a canvas showing an armed black man at a time when black men in much of America were not allowed to bear arms. He knew the war could not have been won without French help. He knew it would scarcely have been worth winning without the principles that animated it. Still, there are gaps. One, which he meant to fill, though he never got around to it, was geographic. You would not know from his telling that anything important in the Revolution happened south of Virginia. One gap never seems to have occurred to him. Many Americans fought for or sympathized with the other side. Because Trumbull's story was so important to him, and he believed to America and to the world, his 8-part narrative of the Revolution and his standing portrait of Washington, which he wanted hung with it, will be described in this book when they are finished, displayed in the gallery he built for them and arranged as he chose. The rest of his life, other paintings he painted, paintings he studied, family, teachers, lovers, battles, quarrels, will be told as it unfolds. How many Americans today sympathize with the story Trumbull tells? Trumbull never sculpted. If he had, his statues might have been graffitied and smashed, as those of other artists depicting his same subjects have recently been. Trumbull's paintings, hung too high to be easily damaged, witnessed a mob bent on overturning a presidential election pass through the Capitol. Most Americans are not vandals or rioters, but we have been revolutionaries. We still wage wars. Trumbull knew that. Even successful wars can bring as many defeats as victories. Trumbull knew that, too. War and politics, history itself, are tales of slaughter and oppression, unless they lead to freedom and peace. But brave and thoughtful men and women can achieve those ends. Trumbull believed that and wants to show it. When I first saw Trumbull's wall, I was not an art historian in training, nor have I become one. Now, as then, I am a visitor with a pair of open eyes. I do come to him as a historian and a citizen. Trumbull understood the American Revolution to be more than an episode of power politics or even of colonials resisting imperial overlords. It was a true revolution, a profound change in how people thought about their political condition, the first chapter in a worldwide revolution of self-rule. How to win self-rule and how to keep it has been an issue for every people, East and West, North and South, for 250 years. Trumbull's story may inspire those struggling with despots or invaders. It can challenge those who do not understand what or how fragile self-rule is. It is still worth seeing and pondering. 1. John Trumbull drew his first pictures on the floor of his family's house in Lebanon, Connecticut, copying pictures made by his older sister Faith that hung over the mantle in the parlor. Embroidering and painting were skills taught to genteel young ladies in 18th century England and even in transatlantic colonies. As an old man, Trumbull recalled copying his sister's productions. "I endeavored to imitate them, and for several years the nicely sanded floors were constantly scrawled with my rude attempts at drawing." Faith's paintings have not survived, but some of her embroideries have, pieces painted on cloth, then worked over in stitched thread. Although the figures in them are crude, the scenes are elaborate. Groups of men, women, and animals, in poses copied from 17th and 18th century European prints, are arranged in landscapes with local houses and trees, oaks by the look of the leaves. Some of the activities depicted are drawn from ordinary life. A woman milks a cow. Others are fanciful, or at least fanciful for 18th century Connecticut. Another woman in a striped formal dress plays a guitar for a small dog. In the larger pieces, there is rudimentary perspective, people shrunken by distance standing in remote fields or on the far shore of a pond. The paintings and embroideries that young John saw in the parlor resemble the world, yet each one creates a new world. Like every artist's world, these worlds are simpler than the one we inhabit. The bombardment of visual data that we learn as infants to construe as bodies in space is further pared down and focused. These worlds are also timeless. The people and creatures in them may have come from elsewhere or be about to do something else, but now they are arrested. Spare and still as they are, however, the artist's worlds allow a viewer to imagine, to wonder why the figures before him are there, or what might happen next, to put himself in the scene. They unlock imagination. If a viewer is so inclined and so gifted, he could recreate them, or in recreating, alter them. Painters always begin by painting other paintings. The psalmist says, "The days of our years are 70 years and 10. John Trumbull's life as a painter would last at least that long. It began with a boy scrawling on the floor. The Trumbull House still stands in Lebanon at one end of the long town green. It is simultaneously plain and imposing for a rural village, 2 stories, 4 rooms down, 4 rooms up. On the back wall of a closet off the second floor girls' room, John had 2 sisters, Faith and Mary, there is a wispy chalk sketch of 2 figures, a man and a woman. Scratched into the wall of one of the ground floor rooms are floral doodles, traced with a compass. The sketch and the compass work might be John's. His own second floor room was once undeniably, if discreetly, ornamented by him. He painted the inner side of a cupboard door with a noble Roman, defending his daughter's honor with a sword. The Roman is now in a museum in Hartford. The cupboard in John's old room yawns, doorless. No other traces of John's youthful efforts remain in the house where he grew up. We do not know what his mother, also named Faith, or Flora, the family's slave, thought of his floor work. It must have complicated their work in keeping the floor nicely sanded. John was the baby of the family, the youngest of 6 children, and the pet of his sisters. They may have humored his imitations of Faith's handiwork. We can with more confidence imagine what Jonathan Trumbull Sr., John's father, thought of his son's artistic efforts. Very little. Genteel boys were not taught painting and embroidery, but were groomed to take up serious work, business, the ministry, the law, as Jonathan himself had been, as his older sons, Joseph, Jonathan Jr., and David were. Indifference to visual arts had deep roots in the world of John's youth. Connecticut and its neighboring colonies in British North America were children of Calvin. The Congregational Church was established by law and supported by taxes. The Word, as revealed in the Bible and expounded by the clergy, was its lone art form. Religious painting and sculpture were tools of Rome, not noble ancient Rome, but degenerate Catholic Rome. The Congregationalist meeting houses of New England were undecorated, except in some older ones, for the Almighty's all-seeing and unwinking eye depicted on the pulpit. Thus, Calvinism, as established by the first wave of settlers. As the decades passed, prosperity and commerce, in a word, luxury, softened these foundational prejudices. The wealthy and the aspiring in port cities and towns, and even inland crossroads, acquired a taste for rich fabrics and elegant furniture, imported from London or made to order by local artisans. Yet radicals and rabble-rousers would periodically appear to denounce finery, even as the pious were liable to worry that it betokened vanity. John's talents bucked a slackening but still powerful current. One other feature of the Trumbull House, John believed, marked his later artistic life. The main staircase, with a sleek banister and a curved landing at the top, rose in the center of the house, but there was a back stairs leading from his sister's room as steep as a ladder, plunging 13 steps straight down from the second to the ground floor. Playing with Faith and Mary one day, frolicking, as he put it, John fell down these stairs and was knocked out, with a great bruise over his left eye. After he recovered, he squinted for a few days, then thought no more of his injury, until several years after, when he found, in closing his right eye, that he could no longer see out of his left. His partial loss of sight was a fact that lay in the back of his mind for the rest of his life. When John was a young man, Gilbert Stuart, a fellow painter, joked that one of his canvases looked as if it had been painted by a one-eyed man. John blazed up, thinking that Stuart knowingly mocked him. Stuart had no idea of his friend's condition. It was a josh gone wrong. John was not amused. Trumbull blamed his disability on his accident, but his fall could not have produced such a long-delayed reaction. His partial blindness must have had some other cause, unless, as sometimes happens, the damage was immediate and it took a long time for it to be noticed. People seldom blink alternately and deliberately unless they are performing some special task, threading a needle, sighting a gun. Seeking causes and explanations, Trumbull linked two shocks, his fall, his loss of the use of an eye. Eyes are how painters see the world and the new worlds they make. Trumbull only had one left. The desire to paint and the possibility that he might be unable to, both came from home. They were twin inheritances. Lebanon lies in the gently rising highlands of eastern Connecticut. The town brook drains ultimately into the Thames River at Norwich, 12 miles to the southeast. 12 miles south of Norwich lay New London and Long Island Sound. Hartford, the colony's capital, was 30 miles west of Lebanon. Boston, one of the largest ports in Britain's New World, was 100 miles to the northeast. A post road connecting these two towns passed Lebanon a few miles to the north. Lebanon, the year John was born, was one of Connecticut's larger towns and was within easy distance of yet more prominent places. Jonathan Trumbull, John's father, was born in Lebanon in 1710, the second son of Joseph Trumbull, a farmer and drover. Joseph prospered to the point of marketing his cattle in Boston and dreamed of trading with Barbados. He tapped Joseph Jr., his eldest son, to be his merchant partner, and sent Jonathan to Harvard, intending him for the clergy. But after Joseph Jr. went down with the family's first ship on its maiden voyage, Jonathan was called to replace him in the family business. Jonathan never lost the marks of his religious training. Every year he read the Old Testament in Hebrew. His considered opinion as an adult was that the two great enemies of Christianity in the modern world were the Sultan and the Pope. In 1735, he married Faith Robinson, the daughter of a Massachusetts minister. There was a shipwreck in her past which had taken the life of her mother. Mrs. Robinson's body was found washed ashore, minus the ring finger, which had been cut off by a scavenger. Over the first 21 years of marriage, Faith bore 6 children. Yet another Joseph, born in 1737, Jonathan Jr., born in 1740, Faith, born in 1743, Mary, born in 1745, David, born in 1751, and finally John, born in 1756. Jonathan Trumbull's merchant career flourished along with his family. By the 1760s, he was buying and selling as far afield as London, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Newport, Rhode Island, and the West Indies. He owned 1,000 acres of land in and around Lebanon, most of which he rented to farmers. His eldest son, Joseph, managed a family office in Norwich. His second son, Jonathan Jr., oversaw a warehouse on the Sound. The flush times ended in 1767, when John was 11. As with most financial crashes, there were more than enough causes. Hard times felt throughout the British Empire found creditors demanding payment. Jonathan's land holdings, though valuable, were illiquid. Still, other ships had been lost at sea. Jonathan managed to give his creditors just enough to avoid technical bankruptcy. But a third son, David, who should have been enrolled at Harvard at this time, as his father and older brothers had been before him, could not be sent there. One other factor contributed to Jonathan Trumbull's business travails, and it had to do with his other business, which had become his primary one, politics. When customers are also constituents, there is a disincentive to collecting their debts rigorously. Hence, another pinch on his resources. And Jonathan Trumbull had been serving and appealing to constituents for decades. Connecticut, according to its 17th century charter, had both an elected legislature and executive. Only Rhode Island, among Britain's North American colonies, enjoyed an equivalent degree of self-rule. Jonathan was first elected to the General Assembly, the lower, larger house, as early as 1733. He missed serving for the next 2 years, but was re-elected in 1736. And for almost half a century thereafter, voters would send him without interruption to that office or to more exalted ones. He served in the judiciary as well, starting at the county level. There was no separation of powers in colonial Connecticut. In 1766, he became simultaneously deputy governor and chief justice of the colony's superior court. In 1769, his near bankruptcy notwithstanding, he was elected governor. With his jobs came responsibilities in Britain's imperial wars. The mother country had been fighting France on and off since the end of the 17th century. In North America, these conflicts pitted Britain's colonies strung along the Atlantic from Newfoundland to Georgia against an arc of French possessions that swung from Quebec along the shores of the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River down to New Orleans. Connecticut, buffered from the frontier by its neighboring colonies, was not a battlefield. Its role was to support the empire with supplies and men. Jonathan helped the wheels of war turn. In 1756, the year of John's birth, the Seven Years' War, called the French and Indian War in North America, was declared. Jonathan was commissioned to represent Connecticut at intracolonial strategy sessions in New York, Hartford, and Boston. As a merchant-slash-lawmaker, he oversaw the production and distribution of flintlocks and cutlasses, cartridge boxes, and belts. The conflict in North America turned decisively in 1759, when British regulars, after a daring night march, captured the French citadel of Quebec. The 32-year-old commander of the attack, Major General James Wolfe, died at the moment of victory. Politics and war surrounded John's childhood. Art was his personal passion, but he would come to share his father's absorption in public life. John's formal education.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?